Hi, everyone, and welcome to 4Panel, the Geek Show's dedicated comics, graphic novel, manga, and various other thing podcast. My name's Rob, and joining me today are Mick and Andrew.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you guys today?
Not good.
Okay, I guess. I'm confused and bewildered, but more on that later.
And somewhat flustered.
Well, I went to see Atomic Blonde last night, so yes, I'm flustered.
Okay. I don't know what to say. I have no
images in that film that I will enjoy remembering for a good long while to come. Let's just put it that way.
We are still talking about Atomic Blonde, aren't we?
Sir, you are incorrect. There will be moments in that film that you will enjoy for like the next week and a half before we plunge into nuclear apocalypse.
Oh, no one told me that was on its way.
Yeah, that's... Sorry, Mick.
I wish I hadn't booked all those meetings in now.
But
damn.
You know, we've known since like the 20th of January.
Well, no one sent me the email. I wasn't part of the podcast network by then.
None of... you didn't have to be. It was obvious when we had bad haircuts separated by the Pacific.
Oh, that'll all blow over.
Yes, it will blow over. world in a horrible mushroom cloud.
Don't worry, I've got some guys working on it.
Very suspicious about what Mick's job is.
Exactly.
It's either reassuring or deeply disturbing, one or the two. One or the other.
And just speculating as to what Mick looks like in a hoodie, does he look vaguely like Tom Cruise?
No, I'm far too tall.
Oh.
Maybe Mick is like two Tom Cruises in a trench coat.
Besides which, you've seen me in a hoodie, you just don't realise it.
See, you say two Tom Cruises in a trench coat, and you make it sound like, you know, that two guys and a girl, the new comedy series from ABC, two Tom Cruises in a trench coat.
Okay.
Hey, I said comedy series. I didn't say it was going to be any good.
That's true. Not that that bothers ABC.
Exactly.
But it's very progressive of them not to let things like quality get in the way of greenlighting a production.
Absolutely.
So anyway, what's been happening in the world then?
Well, first up, we have everyone's favourite recurring segment, Inhumans Watch.
Oh,
yay!
We need a theme tune for that.
I think it just needs to be someone shaking their... No, just one of the Chuckle Brothers saying, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. Yes, Inhumans Watch. They had a press panel the other day, and it went horribly.
Oh?
That kind of reports basically every question sort of being a variation on why does this look so bad? And just everyone getting super defensive about it.
So who was actually on this panel? I have to ask.
We had the quote-unquote stars of the show, Anson Mount, Surinder Swan, Ewan Rian, and Ellen Woglom, alongside just, what a team of Scott Buck and Jeff Loeb.
What?
Who were both like the showrunner and the head of Marvel TV.
Hang on. Who let Jeff Loeb back in?
Oh no, Jeff Loeb's always been back. Basically what happened is they decided they can't let him write comics anymore, so they're just going to let him run the TV division.
That's a bad idea.
No, it's like he's not like written any of the shows.
You know that thing we said about ABC not letting a bad idea get in the way of greenlighting a project?
Yeah.
That, but for this.
See,
they're never going to let that bad idea.
Because at the moment, we've still got like both series of Daredevil, Jessica Jones, and Luke Cage, and some bits of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. have been pretty good versus the rest of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Iron Fist, Inhuman, the scales are balancing. Inhumans might like tip the balance to Marvel shows being more bad than good.
Well, maybe the scales will tip the other way again in 2018 when we get the new Warriors.
But we also get Cloak and Dagger.
Yeah.
God.
Oh, also, do you want to know someone else who doesn't like the Inhumans trailer?
Who?
The director of the first episode.
Excellent. That's a guarantee of quality.
Just never have I seen a show whose launch has been going so incredibly badly.
I wonder if there's a possibility. Remember a couple of weeks ago on the news, Rob, you covered a comic that had just been pulled with no reason given or anything.
Yep.
I wonder if we'll get that with Inhumans. We'll get to September the 1st, people turn up at IMAX cinemas and it just won't be there.
See, I think you're dramatically underestimating the powers of Marvel and Disney.
Yeah.
what I've just realised, that this whole Trump-North Korea situation, I bet they've orchestrated it so that the entire human race is wiped out before we can see Inhumans.
Wow, that's bleak.
It's a devious master plan, I'll give them that.
Or is Inhumans actually the devious master plan to melt everybody's brains?
No, because they failed.
I don't know. I've just scrolled down and seen a gif of Medusa's hair. That's
not brain melting, though, is it?
Just, you can almost see the string just like tugging it back.
The thing is, Medusa's hair defies belief more than it does gravity. I watched an extended trailer last night and, oh.
Oh, you lucky duck.
Oh, it hurt.
I'm closing that now because it's too distracting.
Is her hair like a lava lamp?
Kind of is.
It's so cheesy and tacky and awful, but you just can't stop watching.
That is like probably the best metaphor for it.
It's also ludicrously expensive for what it is.
Yes. And it really does nothing in particular.
Yeah. It's a complete waste of time and effort on everybody's part.
Oh, and was also only relevant in the 70s.
Anyway, would we like some news that's less bleak and horrifying?
Can I just say one positive thing about Inhumans?
Yeah.
Everybody's... I don't know. Can you?
I can, because I was doing some research into the new fall premieres, as the Americans like to call them. Everybody seems to love Lockjaw.
I mean, I like Lockjaw as a character. Not sure I'd love him as a weird pile of CGI.
But I'm sure
it's going to be very quickly like pushed to the side once the budget starts running out even more than it already has.
But the feedback I saw from all the comments was that everybody loved Lockjaw, but the rest of it looked awful. So maybe he'll get his own show.
I said that as well. That was the best thing about the trailer, was Lockjaw. And yes, it was a crappy mess of CG, but yeah. You got to try and look for something positive.
See, I just can't wait till like episode 10, when Lockjaw's entire appearance is just like one paw reaching around a door, and that's all you see of him.
And it's actually just a stagehand's hand in a furry glove.
Yes.
A la Thunderbirds.
Hang on.
No, even better, I think they should go the Battlestar Galactica route and just like dress a chimpanzee up in a dog costume.
Are we still talking about Lockjaw, or are we talking about Medusa's hair? I'm confused now. Because I'm sure Medusa's hair is just somebody in a cousinette costume, and they've just dyed it red. And they're just on her shoulders and just waving it about.
Anyway, here's a random thought. Have you got any news people might want to hear?
Yep. So, the world right now is bleak and horrible. Shall we go somewhere much happier and more optimistic?
Yes, let's.
Mega City 1!
Yay! What?
So I think we've mentioned before, there's plans to do a sequel to the Dread movie, kind of as a TV series.
Yes.
And we've got some news now that Carl Urban is officially in talks to be Judge Dredd again.
Okay.
Which makes me very happy.
Well, he's got the jaw for it. He's got the chin for it.
And not only that, but I think he's gone on record as saying that he's got no problem with donning the helmet again.
Mm.
So I think the talks are probably just about dotting I's, crossing T's, and making sure schedules don't clash.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really hope so. No, anyway, that was kind of just a little thing. A little bit of brightness in this bleak, horrible world.
But as you alluded to, when you're using Mega City 1
yeah,
to bring brightness to a bleak world, it really is a bleak, bleak world.
Yeah.
I just can't wait till the Judge Dredd comics are held up as like a shining example of utopian fiction. Everyone's just sitting around wistfully thinking, God, remember when people thought we'd still have electricity in the future? Those were the days.
They're already thinking that now in
people
some parts of the
living
US, aren't
in they? Buildings. Oh, those wacky ideas.
Again, they're already thinking that now in certain parts of the US.
But of course there will be that dark corner of reality where people are still criticising 2000 AD's depiction of radioactive wastelands.
Yeah, but there's that dark corner of the world where people are still, you know, still believe that Margaret Thatcher's running the country somehow.
She is. from a bunker that she was hidden in.
Somewhere she's got John Major as a footstool.
Yes.
And Tony Blair is like her fanboy.
And her living room is carpeted with the skins of dead socialists.
Yes.
You've had this conversation before, right?
Yes.
I just got the weirdest sense of deja vu. Like, this isn't something I should be deja vuing about.
Well, it's not that me and Mick have had this conversation before, but it's just a conversation that's probably happened within, like, you know, the collective unconscious.
Maybe we all remember it because it's secretly true.
Yes.
It's our unconscious mind trying to warn us.
It's a race memory.
Yes.
Do we have any more news?
Yes, I've got some news.
No, back off, Rob. Not you yet. I'll slap your hand away like a naughty school child.
All right.
Because we have fairly big news that Netflix has bought Millerworld.
Yeah, I read about this and I thought that's a surprising move, but understandable.
Yeah, so Millerworld, that's Mark Millar's company.
Yeah.
Sort of incorporates. See, interesting, because in the headlines, it's basically saying the company behind Kick-Ass and Kingsman. But does that mean Netflix own the rights to those two now?
Pretty much, yeah. Well, they will do eventually with Kick-Ass and Kingsman. I think with Kick-Ass, they'll definitely own the rights to it because there's not going to be a Kick-Ass 3 movie. So what?
Yeah, that's
probably...
true. But I was thinking more Kingsman because the sequel to that is only just about to come out, isn't it?
Yeah, I think Dark Horse? I think it was on the rights to Kingsman.
That's surely the comic, right? It's not the movie rights.
Hmm.
See, this is the complex world of comic book-related product rights.
No, I think Miller World. I think they do actually own the rights to Kingsman now.
I know they would own the rights to begin with, since Mark Millar's the one who made it.
I think Miller World is its own imprint.
God, copyright law's confusing.
Yeah, I think you know how Mark Millar's stuff came out on Dark Horse, but then I know Superior is on Miller World. I know Kick-Ass was part of Miller World. I think Kingsman was part of Miller World as well. And if on the spine it says Miller World, I think that it's basically the rights are owned by Netflix now. Maybe the movie rights for the second movie are still owned by whoever the movie distributor is. But I think after the second movie, they probably have to renegotiate the contract with Netflix this time.
The law's weird.
Yes, I know. But it's a massive thing.
Basically, it means that Netflix could end up like making their own sort of cinematic universe type thing.
I would love for them to try their hand at Superior, which was Mark Millar's homage to Superman. I'd love to see them do that.
See, what I'm interested in, this is going to sound like a bit of a diss to Mark Millar, but I kind of hope they improve a lot of them. I feel like I've said this before, that Mark Millar, he has a lot of good ideas.
Yep.
But then because he has so many, he won't maybe spend as much time fleshing them out as he could.
Yeah, I mean, the one that I did the other week, Empress, I'm not sure how they'd approach that series. I mean, there's one trade paperback out for it so far. So there's nowhere near enough content to start producing a TV series or anything like that.
But then, I had a feeling that Empress was Marvel.
It sounds like it's Marvel. Because
I'm sure I've seen adverts for it on the Marvel website.
Oh, it's definitely Mark Millar. I've got it literally sitting in front of me right now. It's Millar World, Mark Millar, and Stuart Immonen.
Weird.
Yeah, I know.
But yeah, I guess they'll give that one a bit more time. Or they'll just, like, spin it off in their own direction.
Actually, I can tell you the titles that are a part of Miller World.
Do that, Rob.
Obviously, there's Kick-Ass. And then there's a kind of a one-shot called Hit Girl. Empress, obviously. There's that one, other Superman-type one, Hook, which I really enjoyed.
You mentioned that a while ago.
Yep. Chrononauts. MPH.
Oh, yeah. Chrononauts was okay.
Yep. MPH. Starlight. Kingsman, the Secret Service, Jupiter's Circle, which I believe you read at one point, didn't you?
Oh, yes, right. Yeah, that was fairly interesting.
Yeah, and there's Jupiter's Legacy. That comes after that. Super Crooks, Superior, Nemesis, Wanted, and American Jesus.
Okay, so they've got plenty of stuff to choose from.
Yeah.
Actually, this might help Netflix as well.
Yeah. I mean,
a lot of their original movies have been less than stellar.
Yeah.
So hopefully having a more stable background to work from will help them out.
I mean, if they thought about it, they could probably do a reboot of Kick-Ass.
I would be down for that.
Or they could try and adapt Kick-Ass to be a TV series. Don't know how that would work.
Well, you could spend a lot longer developing the shall we say, tangential characters, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, so, and kind of the other side of this story is that I think they might be looking for some new superhero TV shows.
Okay.
Because kind of the big news story of the moment, which I didn't realize has a big impact for comics until I thought about it, Disney's going to start their own streaming service.
Yes, they are. And they pulled the movies from Netflix, haven't they?
Yeah, and that could mean that all the Marvel Netflix shows are going to follow suit.
Possibly. It's definitely possible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, so that's all the news I've got. Bob, you had a thing, maybe.
That was the thing.
Netflix. I was flat out stealing the ball rather than just like slapping it out of your hand.
Yeah, you just ran up and just beat me to the ground and nicked my ball.
I'm okay with that.
The only other thing I could mention, possibly, and it wasn't even worth a mention, was just the apparently Milla Jovovich is going to play the bad guy in the new Hellboy movie.
Surely that'd be Bad Girl.
I'm not sure about her these days.
Look, if Tilda Swinton can play a 900-year-old Tibetan man, Milla Jovovich can play a bad guy.
Marker.
Yeah, I feel like Milla Jovovich is one of those actors I just cannot say anything about.
Her husband's Paul W.S. Anderson, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Hence why she's the lead in, like, all the Resident Evil films.
It is kind of saying to everyone, though, look, this is my wife. Look at her. I married her.
Look how better than all the Resident Evil characters she is.
Yes.
Sorry. I pride myself. I've never watched a Resident Evil movie.
They're not. You know how you've forgotten the X-Men movies?
Yeah.
The Resident Evil movies are worse.
Right.
Yes. In fairness, I watched a number of those movies, possibly the same ones multiple times. I don't really know.
Yeah. The other thing is, I've never really played a Resident Evil game, which is probably what explains why I've never watched one of the movies.
See, I've seen all of the Resident Evil movies, and you know the only thing I remember from them? There's only two things I remember. In one, she shoots a zombie in the face with a shotgun. And in another one, she kicks a zombie dog. That's it. That's all I remember.
First one had the laser grid, which was like the one kind of cool scene in the entire franchise.
See, now that you mentioned the laser grid, I remember it, but I'd forgotten the laser grid in favour of the dog kicking.
That says a lot about you, Rob. And I'm not entirely sure that it's a good thing.
Hey, I got chased by a lot of dogs when I was a kid. There's trauma there, man. Trauma.
But no, I remember at the end of one of the films, like, she opened a door, and it was just full of a bunch of clones of her, which I think we're getting a bit too into Paul W.S. Anderson's private fantasies.
I was going to say. on that note, shall we take a break?
Yeah, let's do it.
The Geek Show is the largest independent podcast network out there, and to be independent, we need a little bit of help every now and again. So if you want something to show your love of The Geek Show, head over to thegeekshow.co.uk, click on the shop and buy some of our lovely wares.
This is Tony Bennett from Knockabout Comics and you're listening to The Geek Show.
Ah, there really is nothing like a first leather-bound edition of a classic Victorian podcast. Hello, we're Literary Loitering from The Geek Show and we cover literally all types of books, from hardbacks to paperbacks to sometimes the words within them. If any of these things interest you, why not pop in and give us a visit on Literary Loitering.
Welcome back, and now it's time for comics and manga of a sort, starting with Mick.
Hello. So, this week I have The Inkle by Jodorowsky with art by Moebius. And I've got to say that in this weighty tome of some 300 pages, there's a good story somewhere. Desperately trying to get out. But the thing is, it's great. If you like concept, then there's a new one coming at you every four frames. And that's the problem with it. It's like reading a story that's been written by an imaginative five-year-old, where you've asked them about what they did that morning and they start telling you about their trip to school and they get on a bus and then the bus driver turned into a dinosaur, and then the dinosaur got attacked by some birds, and then they nearly fell over, and then the aliens came, and they shot at the bus. It's that kind of concept without any real structure, so you don't get a feeling for the world that you're inhabiting, or indeed the structure of the story. And the Inkle is described as this all-powerful sort of weapon that's in various sections that have to be combined. But it just feels like a MacGuffin, because in order to get out of any bit of peril, oh, the Inkle will sort it out. And it does. There's no structure to what its capabilities are. The main character, John DeFool, is described as an R-class private detective, but there's like no indication as to where on the scale that is. I mean, you could assume it's an alphabetical scale with A-class private detectives being the best, but you don't meet any other private detectives that are anywhere else on the scale. You meet one class of political agitators, but you don't really learn anything about them. You can kind of guess their motivations from their name, but beyond that, you don't really learn anything about them, why they do what they do, why they feel the way that they feel. And it's just a mess. I'm about two-thirds of the way through, and I would say that of the sort of 200-odd pages that I've already read, maybe 30 of them would have been able to tell the story if you'd just done it as a story rather than trying to introduce a new concept every couple of pages.
Do you know, that might be why I enjoyed the Free Comic Book Day issue a lot more, was because it was a bite-sized chunk.
It might well be. Yeah. The interesting thing on here is that there is an introduction by Brian Michael Bendis thanking Jodorowsky and Moebius for their inspiration, because this is how he learned how to write comics. And I think that explains Civil War II.
Well, it explains a lot more than Civil War II.
It's okay. You know, it's not so bad that I've thought, right, I'm putting this down, and even for the sake of reviewing it on the podcast, I'm not going to finish it. I probably will finish it, but you know the rate at which I normally devour a graphic novel, and I'm struggling with this because there's too much concept coming at me and not enough actual A leads to B leads to C stuff going on.
See, I like the way you described it, you know, as like a five-year-old going to school with the dinosaurs, everything like that. I thought that is probably the most perfect description of Jodorowsky that I've ever heard. And also, the whole thing that you described just sounds like a storyline from Calvin and Hobbes.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. But even with Calvin and Hobbes, they were small bite-sized chunks. So you only had to grasp the concept for that small period of time, whereas this is 300 pages of just, here's a concept, here's a concept, here's a concept, here's a concept, this concept will blow your mind.
Yeah, but wouldn't this be so much better if it was the Inkle versus Spaceman Spiff?
If I knew what that latter thing was, maybe.
It's Calvin's alter ego.
If.
Yes, if. I have no idea what you're talking about, Spaceman Spiff.
Calvin and Hobbes.
Oh, it must be 25 years since I've picked up a Calvin and Hobbes collection.
Oh. You need to pick up more Calvin and Hobbes.
I don't have time. You keep giving me these Jodorowsky volumes.
Sorry.
It's all your fault.
I mean, that is the essence of the show. Kind of dangle good comics in front of you while forcing you to deal with swill.
Yeah. I want to like it because it's got a space opera feel, but it's like someone took all the concepts out of 2001. And all the concepts out of Barbarella, and all the concepts out of an as yet unreleased East European sci-fi epic, then took some LSD, put them in a blender, and wrote out what came out of that. It's difficult to wrap your head around, is basically it. And I've wrapped my head around quite a lot of things.
Well, you're an avid 2001 reader. You've seen strangeness like nobody else has seen.
Absolutely. So I want to stop talking about it now because it's making my brain hurt.
Okay.
Andrew, shall we move on to me then?
Yes. Something simpler, please.
That's actually a very good lead-in. I've got something much simpler, which is Glister by Andy Watson. So Glister is a series of things, about four kind of full-length stories and lots of little bits of other things about Glista Butterworth, a young girl who is a magnet for the strange and peculiar. And there's kind of a series of delightfully absurd adventures that she has. So story one is of Glista and the haunted teapot, in which she finds a teapot which is possessed by the ghost of a writer who tries to press Ganger into finishing his great novel.
Damn these dead writers.
It's a constant thorn in your side, isn't it, when dead writers try to force you to finish their work for them?
Yeah.
It is a problem I'm often forced to deal with. Then the second story, Glista and the House Hunt, is about her hunting for her house, because she lives in the sentient Chilblain Manor, which one day decides, basically after being told it can't enter the Bonnie Village competition, decides it's going to travel the world.
It didn't grow duck feet and suddenly start walking away, did it?
No, it just kind of ploughs through the earth.
I was going to say, if it grew duck feet, then Glista is obviously Baba Yaga.
No, Glista is not the Baba Yaga. But that kind of ties into the third one.
Oh, wow.
Which, because these first two are just like full of fun and whimsy. But then we get Glista and the Fairy Host, in which Glista learns that her mother isn't really dead, as in fact being kept a prisoner of the Fairy King.
Wow.
The Fairy King in this being like the proper old school horrifying trickster demon with a face that looks like a rotting pumpkin.
That got dark quick, didn't it?
Yeah, just say it takes a sudden, like it's proper like this full on almost horror of her like wandering around this strange dimension where like she's forced to constantly go in circles and everyone keeps trying to convince her to like eat or drink so that she'll be trapped in the fairy world forever. And then it goes back in the fourth story to Glista and the family tree, where she uses the Butterworth family tree to grow some new relatives.
Okay, how does that work? And are they pod people?
No, it's kind of, I mean, I say it's whimsical, but when you think about it, it's kind of horrifying.
Yeah.
Basically, over the years, she's like hidden her baby teeth in the tree, and that like gives her the power to make a wish, which then causes the tree to pull various relatives from out of time and space.
This is beginning to sound a lot less sweetness and light.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. Like all the stories are quite sweet and fun, but there is like a slightly darker under. I mean, it's basically like classical fairy tales.
Yeah.
Where it's fun, but there's like a bit of a dark streak running through it.
Okay.
And quite frankly, it's the kind of thing I'm in favour of. Because this is aimed at like quite a young audience. I could probably say pre-teenager. But I like that it falls into the sort of Adventure Time-esque camp of, say, you know, just because we're for a younger audience doesn't mean we're going to talk down to them.
All right, okay, that's really good.
Yeah, it is, and it's just, it's highly enjoyable.
Hmm. And when I gave you this, you were very, very hesitant.
I was, because it does look very cutesy and childlike.
Are you glad?
But it does. It has a very, very nice sense of humour.
Yeah. It's another Princess Jellyfish, isn't it? Where the looks are deceiving.
It is quite a bit like Princess Jellyfish.
The looks are highly deceiving, just don't be fooled by how it looks.
And there's lots of funny. I think probably my favourite character is the Toll Troll. Lives under a bridge and demands silver to like pass into Chilblain Manor, but will happily accept bottle caps.
Okay. Silver or bottle caps.
Yeah, but it's just anything shiny. Until eventually he takes over the wishing well and starts demanding gold, because he's now a business owner.
This is beginning to sound a lot more like Trump.
Yeah, that's the line. This is kind of one of the lines that made me almost laugh out loud. Basically, silver's the bridge toll, gold for a wish, no exceptions, strictly against folkloric creatures' rural byways regulations.
Oh, Fables would have been a very, very different series if they had like health and safety regulations like that.
Yes, it would. But yeah, Glista, it's one of those fun series that like parents can read to their kids, as everyone can enjoy.
Excellent.
So, on to you then.
Yes, and I'm taking a trip to Japan, quite literally. I have Furari.
No, you're not, Rob. You're metaphorically taking a trip to Japan.
Well,
you're not like stopping reading, standing up, leaving the house, booking a flight to Tokyo and going there right now.
Well,
that would be literally going to Japan, Rob. This is metaphor. There's a difference.
You say that?
You've sparked the grammar Nazi in me, Rob.
Hold on. You say that, but Furari by Jiro Taniguchi kind of does transport you to a historical part of Japan.
And so what you're saying is in reading it, it's like you've taken a trip to Japan, almost like some kind of metaphor.
Kind of yes and kind of no.
It has not physically transported you to Japan.
Now you're being pedantic.
No, I'm not. I'm being grammatically correct.
You were the one who inappropriately used the word literally.
Anyway, enough of the pedants. Let's crack on.
That is just one of the red flags.
Yes, enough of the pedantry. Let's crack on. Furari by Jiro Taniguchi is a very strange manga.
Wait, hold up. Can we just have one? So it's called Furari.
Furari, F-U-R-A-R-I.
Oh, because I feel like I need to point out, before the show started, you were talking about it.
You thought it was Ferrari.
I didn't think it was Ferrari.
Yeah, a lot of people made that mistake as well. And
so many car jokes ready, and now they're all ruined.
Well, the thing is, when you search for it on Google, you'll have Ferrari, Jiro Taniguchi, and Furari, Jiro Taniguchi, which tells you how many people have made that mistake. So you're not the first, and you won't be the last. But Jiro Taniguchi, he's done something strange that I've rarely seen in manga. Number one, this is a lovely hardback manga with really nice pages. You know how the pages feel in certain books and graphic novels and comics and that? The feel of the pages in this is really nice. The artwork's really nice and detailed. Everything is really expression. It is really well detailed. It's really nice. There's a simplicity to it, but that belies the level of detail in like the backgrounds and stuff like that. The story has been inspired by an actual historical figure called Tadataka Ino, who lived from 1745 to 1818. And the main character in Furari is, he's basically retired, and he is just wandering around the districts of Edo, the ancient version of Tokyo, and he's just wandering around enjoying the thousand little pleasures, and he surveys, measures, draws, and takes notes, and just basically measures everything. He does everything in a slow and measured approach. But the fascinating thing about this is that, and it's mainly a story about him just wandering around enjoying Edo in a way that nobody else does. And every so often, it basically switches to him kind of imagining what it would be like as if he was a cat traveling through Edo, you know, just on the prowl, or if he was a turtle or a bird or something like that. And that's when the story takes on this kind of slightly magical feel, because then it takes the first person perspective of the actual animal. And he's kind of, he's just passing it off as if he's had a dream, and his wife just brushes it off as if he's just, he's just had a summer dream or a winter dream or something kooky like that. But every day, every adventure, every little adventure is kind of sweet and charming and heartwarming. It's a very different manga to what I expected. I thought it was going to be about something a lot more serious. And there are serious moments in this.
But like when he has to team up with the other animorphs.
No, unfortunately, he doesn't transform into an animal, thankfully. The things that I wrote about this is, number one, you read this more like a Western graphic novel rather than a manga. So you read it from left to right rather than right to left.
Heresy.
Yeah, I know. And number two, a lot of the artwork, it looks like this is one of those rare manga that was actually done on, using a graphics tablet and a PC rather than pen and paper to start off with. And the reason I say that is because, when you read graphic novels and comics and manga, and you can tell the difference between something that has originally been hand-drawn as opposed to something that has been done using a PC and a graphics tablet, because of, how straight certain lines are, that sort of thing.
Yes, that's a thing I've noticed. You too, right, Mick?
Yes. In fact, I was pondering whether the inkle had bit. No, it wasn't.
Well, I do notice things like that.
I mean, I can spot it in certain mainstream comics that they've not been near a pencil since original concept.
Yeah.
I don't think it's generally a thing that I can spot.
Possibly it's easier to see it in manga, because a lot of manga is done in the old way, where they draw it by hand first. So when something is purely digital, it tends to stand out a bit more. And because I mainly read manga anyway, I'm just, my eyes are a lot more used to reading, to seeing these lines that are not quite straight, so to speak. So when you see your character and the face, you know, the lines for the face are pretty much identical every time the character looks at a certain, you know, the character is viewed from a certain angle, as if it was like a block print.
Okay.
Do you see what I mean? That's kind of a giveaway for it, because nobody's so perfect as to be able to do that all the time. But that isn't to its detriment. It actually works in its favor because it gives this a very different feel when you read it. It's slightly clinical, but I think that works with the actual story, because the guy is just going around enjoying the little pleasures and measuring. He's counting his steps and working things out and calculating things. And at the beginning, you just kind of go, why is he doing this? What's the point of counting how many steps it is across the bridge? Or how many steps it is from this point to that point? What's the point of all of this? And on the back, it actually does give you an explanation. It says, I would like to make proper measurements of the topography of this country's unassuming natural features and to draw up maps that will be left to future generations. And that kind of gives you a sense that the main character is somebody who is making maps and wants to, you know, the accurate measurements. But these are the little stories that happen in between all of the boring work. So yeah, if you want something that's very, very different to your normal manga fare, then I'd say check it out.
Oh.
I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I have literally no idea how to add to that.
Yeah.
Anyway, on to you, Mick.
Okay, so in what I like to think of as my traditional slot now, Valerian, Volume 3 of the Complete Collection.
Yes.
Which features three complete stories. One of which we've already covered in so much as it was The Ambassador of Shadows, which we covered because that's the main inspiration behind the largely disappointing movie. But the other two stories in it are something of a slight variation from the normal fare. And one of my big problems with the movie was that it kind of glossed over the fact that Valerian works for the Spatio-Temporal Service and therefore is as likely to be investigating issues on a temporal scale and dealing with miscreants who've gone back in time to cause havoc, as he is to be travelling the galaxy to fight off alien invaders or ambassadors who've got dodgy agendas or whatever it may be. Also in these stories, it shows Loreline as the sort of brains behind the operation, whereas Valerian tends to be the sort of gung-ho soldier type. I'll go in with my guns blazing. How can that possibly fail? And Loreline's the more sort of, hold on a minute, why don't we just find out what's going on? And so in this collection, that very much comes to the fore. So the second story in the collection, after The Ambassador of the Shadows, is On the False Earths, where we are taken on a roller coaster journey through various times in Earth's history. We go to world war zones, we go to Renaissance Italy, we go to prehistoric times, all on the trail with the aid of an accomplished historian, of someone who's setting up these fake Earths to tempt someone out of hiding, basically just so that they can go, look at me, I'm brilliant. But it's an interesting thing because obviously coming from the future, there are certain bits of equipment that Valerian is used to using. He's from the future. He's got communicators and all the rest of it. And suddenly he's stuck in these situations where instead of pulling a laser blaster to defend himself, he's got to use a bow and arrow or a spear or a musket or something. So you've got that kind of problem for him to deal with. And it's the typical Valerian, fast-paced, beautifully illustrated, innocent yet still romantic relationship between Valerian and Loreline. Are you listening, Dane DeHaan and Cara Delevingne? and Luke Besson, he's not without blame on that. And so that, you know, it's another sort of different story. And then the final story in the collection is Heroes of the Equinox, which starts off as a fairly straightforward tale. Basically, they arrive on a planet where no children have been born for a very long time, and a large proportion of the planet's population in the main city are sterile. So what happens is that the equinox, which happens every 5 centuries or so, is celebrated by inviting the finest warriors of the galaxy to go on a quest to the island where the Earth Mother lives, and whichever one survives the journey gets to have a special cuddle with the Earth Mother and produce the next generation of the planet's population, which is all fine and dandy. The four heroes arrive, they set off on their journey, there's an electrical storm over the sea between the major city and the island, but they make it through there intact, and then they all have a physical challenge to overcome, which may be an endurance challenge of crossing a desert or climbing a mountain, and then they have a mental challenge, so it might be a psychological facing their fears type challenge.
Basically, they do with the Krypton factor.
They basically do the Krypton. It's a kind of combination. It's like the best bits of the Krypton factor mixed with the best bits of the Crystal Maze.
Do they have an assault course at the end?
Well, it's kind of all an assault course. It's like the assault course from Krypton Factor, but at various bits of the assault course, they have to break off to do a mental challenge. And anyway, ultimately, at the end, Valerian makes it to the final challenge alongside his fellow travelers. And they are, the final hurdle is they are asked by this Earth Mother what they perceive the future generation will be like if they are the father, the progenitor of the next generation of this species. And so, of course, you get someone from a mighty warrior race saying that he will lead them through a great, glorious expansion of invasion and strength and all the rest of it. And then another one says he will do it by planning their economy and making them grow. Another one says he'll do it a slightly different way by making them grow as a center for trade and tourism. And then she turns around to Valerian and says, and what would you do? And I'm not going to give away the answer.
Okay.
Because it's a bit different. But needless to say, it appeases the Earth Mother, and Valerian fathers the next generation of this planet's population. And they all return back to the island with the new young people, except Valerian. He's missing from the returning vessel. And so they go off looking for Valerian. Loreline goes off looking for Valerian. And she finds him and finds that he's been given his reward by the Earth Mother for being successful. And that is that he gets to live happily ever after on the island as a tiny person. I mean, fits in the palm of your hand.
Okay.
And that's how the story ends. Loreline manages to extricate him from the hands of the Earth Mother and puts him on the ship. And he's sat on the ship with Loreline being very cross, because obviously he's been off with this Earth Mother, and him going, well, what could I do? I had to save the people. It was all in me.
That old chestnut.
Yeah.
Do you know what it sounds like? You remember that Futurama episode with Snoo Snoo? It literally sounds like that. Snoo Snoo.
And so I don't know where we're going to go next. I'm been trying to look to see if there is a volume 4 of the complete collection. So I'm hoping that it'll pick up with Valerian still being tiny and them trying to find some kind of cure for it. But basically, Valerian has now turned into Baby Groot.
Oh, please pick up from Valerian being tiny.
Coming for volume 4, Valerian in my pocket.
But Valerian, gotta catch them all.
Grandpa Valerian. Tell me more about that time of Snoo Snoo.
But it's still the same quality that I've come to expect from the three volumes. There's a consistency to the quality of the storytelling. There's a consistency to the quality of the artwork. There's no attempt to try and be too arch or too clever just telling a good story in a galaxy of wonders. And it's just a shame that the movie that has been so long awaited just doesn't live up to the source material.
Well, one of these days, Mick, you're going to tell us your real opinions on that movie.
No, they're mine and they're guarded.
Well, you haven't been guarding them very well.
No.
I have a 600-page dissertation if you really want me to go through it.
No. No, we're good. Thank you.
No, I'm unlocking something dark and horrible.
We're good. Thank you. Andrew, your turn.
Yep. I've been reading one of those mangas as well.
Yes.
So I learnt it from you, Rob. I learnt it from you.
Well, the plural of manga is manga.
I think you'll find it's manga pods.
Oh, now he gets pedantic.
Anyway. I've been reading Mobile Suit, Gundam Wing, Endless Waltz, Glory of the Losers. And I'll tell you, it's literally like I sat down and read a manga.
Really?
Really, really.
Literally, not metaphorically?
No, I lied. It was actually metaphorically like that.
Right.
But what I really did was just jolt it about a bit and kind of sniffed it to get its essence.
Okay.
And which could is, you tell of course, how I read all my comics.
And could you tell whether it was hand-drawn or digitally created?
I'm more worried about him wanting to get the essence of Gundam Wing.
Yep. I can absolutely tell that. And I'm just not going to tell you.
Okay. As long as you could tell, that's all that matters.
It's a lot more concerning about sniffing for the essence of Gundam Wing.
It is. Speaking of, so if you're like me and basically like everyone from sort of the 90s, early 2000s, Gundam Wing was pretty much your introduction to the whole giant robots shooty explodey genre, because that was like one of two anime that we had.
The other one being Dragon Ball.
Yep. Like, that was your lot from Japan.
Hey. There was a lot more than that. Cowboy Bebop was a thing.
That's a maybe over-exaggerating for slight comedic effect.
I had Battle of the Planets.
So did I.
That was it, literally it.
No, we had Ulysses as well.
You might have. I didn't.
I forgot you're 8 years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not anyway, the old one, Andrew. I'm not the old one.
Maybe that's why Rob's acting out recently. He's lost his sense of identity.
I'm now the unwanted middle child.
Can we dye your hair red?
No.
Did you notice how we all leapt to assuage that?
No.
No, it's okay.
I may be unwanted, but I will never be ginger.
Rob, you are a valued part of the show. Because otherwise I'd have to work out how to use recording software and I can't be fast with that.
Anyway. Gundam Wing.
Yeah. So, Gundam Wing Endless Subtitles. It's basically, I looked up what this is it's basically the original series, but sort of redone to incorporate all the prequels and backstory stuff that they've released since. And it's, you know when you have kind of a vague memory of something?
Yeah.
Not often that when you go back to it, it's exactly like you remember.
Mm.
But this is, it's a bunch of complete nonsense plot and then some big robots shoot each other and there's lots of explosions.
That sounds like Gundam Wing, all right.
Yeah, because I think even back in the day when I was watching it, I couldn't tell you what the plot was. And having read this, I still can't really. Like, it's the future, and there's colonies in space, and the Earth people don't like the colony people, so the colony people have sent a bunch of Gundams to mess up Earth's bad guys' stuff.
Okay.
And okay. Also, they're all piloted exclusively by pretty boys.
Yeah, that was the one thing I couldn't understand about Gundam Wing. What happened to all the actual soldiers?
Dunno. They weren't fan-artable enough. There's an amazing bit, like, right at the start, where like the evil military commander who's called Trays.
Yeah.
Like he's saying something and it just like he's looking down and then you flip over the page, he suddenly looks up and literally he's like surrounded by sparkles.
Does that never happen to you?
Oh, all the time. But not when I'm having conversations about what are basically terrorists. Because that's the thing. The protagonists of Gundam Wings are basically terrorists.
Yep.
Like, damn.
Thank you for
pointing that out. That's not a thing I realised as a child.
Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. I've been saying that for years. Everyone who's watched Gundam Wing and puts it on a pedestal because it was one of their first anime. They just kind of go, no, it's not glorifying terrorism in any way. I'm like, no, it is. It really is.
Like, they're monsters. Like, they say multiple times, I'm going to have to kill you now because you've seen... Like, that's their whole thing. They're trying to infiltrate Earth, so they have to kill anyone who sees them.
Yep.
But then also one of them has a minigun for an arm, and that's super rad. And he also has miniguns for nipples, and like a bajillion rocket launches on his shoulders and such.
See, why can't they just be peaceful like Crichton, you know? Crichton's nipples only control his temperature and pick up Jazz FM.
So,
and send him to Alaska.
Yes.
I'm so morally conflicted, because they're terrible people, but also the robots are so cool. One of them has a laser scythe. That's rad.
I know what both of those words mean individually.
Basically, it's a scythe, but the choppy bit is made of lasers.
Okay.
I'm not saying a word. I know exactly what he's talking about.
And that is an accurate description.
It is.
No, reading this has just made me sad. I miss the good old days when all I knew about Gundam Wing was, look at these cool robots.
Are you saying that reading this collection has robbed you of your innocence?
It has a bit.
Are you sure it wasn't the last 20 years?
I mean, that's probably done it as well. but apart from that, like, it's a bit hard to read.
Okay.
Because I feel like they've really condensed some stuff. Like, you know how in the show there was that whole plot line with, like, Hero, that's his name. Like, he crash lands and then he has to, like, pretend to be a school kid for a bit. One of the girls has a crush on him, but then he doesn't reciprocate it. But then she finds out who he is, so it's like, oh no, I have to kill you, but I don't want to, but maybe I have to.
Yeah.
That happens like 2 pages.
Do you remember that bit from Moon Girl Devil Dinosaur with Melvar and Moon Girl? He's like, I must destroy you, but I love you.
Yeah, it's basically that, but serious.
Exactly.
But I guess it does that because it realizes the reason I'm reading this, which is basically, let's just power through all this plot nonsense so we can get back to the robots fighting.
Yeah, because when you get right down to it, people who watch Gundam are nostalgic about one thing, the robot fights. They're not nostalgic about the story, they're nostalgic about the robots. And we know from the success of Michael Bay's Transformers that nothing gets the audience riled up more than robot-on-robot action.
Which again, Futurama also taught us, but in a very different way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but, you know, Futurama just kind of led us to the door. Michael Bay opened it and it introduced us to a world of hardcore robot-on-robot action.
No, he opened the door and there was just an explosion.
Yeah, before Optimus Prime tearing someone's face off. Which, yeah, in a normal movie, if they were human characters...
Yeah, Optimus Prime is a psychopath.
I know. And he sticks his sword up through the fallen's chin. You think... Hang on, why is this not an R-rated movie? Wolverine does that to a guy, and it's an R-rated movie. Optimus Prime does it to another robot, and it's fine.
Well, see, even Wolverine's not that bad.
Exactly.
At least Wolverine doesn't, like, make a specific point of having basically already killed a guy, still taking the time to cut his face off.
Yeah, but the thing is, it took Wolverine 7 movies to work his way up to that. It took Optimus Prime 3.
But he was doing it, like, halfway through the first one, wasn't he?
Yeah, true, actually, he was.
And like, I'm pretty sure the second one starts with him just flat out executing someone.
Yeah, it took him less than a movie then, because he was only in for like half of the first movie, wasn't he?
Yeah, so there we go. Gundam Wing, not as like morally horrifying as the Transformers movies.
Yes.
Wasn't there the one episode of Gundam Wing where Hero like slices an aeroplane full of people in half?
Yes, there is. He's a monster.
I've played that show for lots of things about me now.
Yes. He's a monster. Do you know what isn't monstrous, though?
I assume whatever comic you're about to talk about.
Yes.
I know how the show works.
The Adventures of Superhero Girl. This is the expanded edition by Faith Erin Hicks. And this is apparently an Eisner Award winner for Best Publication for Kids. But again, it's a bit like Glister that you had, Andrew, where you can read it as a kid. But I think you'll get more enjoyment reading it as an adult, because you'll understand the jokes better, especially if you're a comic book fan like we are. So, this tells the story of the titular superhero girl, and she is a Canadian superhero who can leap tall buildings, defeat alien monsters with her bare hands, everything like that. But she has to buy her capes from secondhand stores. She struggles to make rent. She has a weakness for kittens. And she has like all sorts of kind of, well, she's not really too sure of herself. She's always wanted to be a superhero. She's got these powers, these Superman-like powers. And everyone expects her to be a superhero, but she's not as good as her older brother, Kevin, who is, he's basically the corporate shill of a superhero. He's, you remember, what's his face from, you know, the corporate superhero from Mystery Men?
Oh, yeah, the...
Captain Freedom, was it, or something like that?
Yeah.
Her older brother, Kevin.
I can picture him, I just cannot remember his name.
Yeah, her older brother, Kevin, is basically that guy. And he's so much better and smarter and stronger and better looking than she is. So anyway, this tells the story of Superhero Girl's daily trials and tribulations. She meets one guy who will...
Captain Amazing, that
Captain
was
Amazing,
it.
Yeah, that was it. I knew he was a captain something.
Oh, yeah, it's played by Greg Kinnear.
But yeah, Superhero Girl, one of her first... She's got like this to-do list, you know, get the mask, get the cape, go out and save people, find an arch nemesis, and then she'll be a full-fledged superhero. And one of the first people that she meets when she's just taking a day off is the person who will forever remain as Skeptical Guy. And he asks her, what kind of superpowers does she have? And she says, oh, the usual Superman powers. You know, she can lift heavy objects, leap over tall buildings, that kind of thing. And he says, you can fly? Flying is cool. She goes, no, I leap over tall buildings. And he says, but you just said you had Superman powers. She said, no, originally Superman could only leap over tall buildings. And then he goes on to say, but you can't be a real superhero because you don't have a proper superhero origin. You know, you're not a rich socialite with too much time on your hands. You don't have a tragic backstory or anything like that. Your parents aren't dead or anything like that. You didn't have a tragedy that changed the way you saw the world forever, you know, or a tragedy that drove you to mete out justice on those who wronged you, blah, blah, blah. You can't be a proper superhero, which, suffice to say, pisses her off a little bit. I like this because Faith Erin Hicks has gone through, you know, all the usual superhero tropes from superhero origin stories about who you are, what you are, with great power comes great responsibility, blah, 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 blah. She goes through all those right at the beginning and gets them all out of the way in kind of a kid-friendly way, but a way that if you understand superhero origins, you'll laugh at them. Oh, and another thing, Superhero Girl lives in a city full of ninjas. There's no actual explanation as to why there are so many ninjas in the city. There just are.
This is a city in Canada, yes?
Yes. It's a city in Canada that's full of ninjas. And they're basically, they're more like rats than they are ninjas. There's ninjas everywhere, you know. There's ninjas when she goes shopping who are doing their shopping, and she hates seeing people from work when she's taking time off.
Terrible ninja infestation.
Yeah. It's like a terrible ninja infestation. The nice thing about this is it also addresses other things that superhero comics just don't. For example, Superhero Girl, she wears a mask, but she keeps forgetting to take the mask off. And one day, it's a sunny day, she's wearing the mask, and the problem is the rest of the face is tanned, and her roommate starts laughing because only around the eyes is it not tanned, so her roommate starts calling her Raccoon Girl because she's got that patch around the eyes where her mask is supposed to be.
Okay.
There is another bit, though, because nobody's ever asked the question, how do superheroes keep their masks on if it's only a kind of over-the-eyes mask? They have, like, a special nose clip, or does it have, like, little hooky things in the side that hook over the ears, or something like that?
I've always assumed it was basically just, like, a big sticker with holes in it.
Yeah. See,
this, again, addresses that particular thing. Her roommate wants to take Superhero Girl out because Superhero Girl has been depressed, and tears her mask off and then says, why the hell did you super glue your mask to your face? She goes, it's the only way I can get it to stay on.
Ouch.
Do you see what I mean?
Right.
I mean, look at Robin. Robin has that, you know, he has that over-the-eye mask. It's not like Batman's cowl. It just sticks over the eyes, doesn't it? How is he keeping it on there?
Almost like Batman isn't a very responsible guardian.
Exactly. I mean, there's other bits as well that just don't get touched on in any Superman comic or anything like that. Except maybe Flash. Superhero Girl just makes the comment that, you know, she's just relaxing in the park. Someone's robbed a bank. She goes, put it back. And he's like, he just goes, okay. Takes the bag back to the bank and hands himself in. She goes, it's good when I've got the criminals of the city trained.
Okay.
I love this. It's a delightful little read. There is a great one, though. It's kind of a role reversal. There's two bits that I want to particularly bring up here. And number one is this supervillain hipster, right? Her brother comes into town and the supervillain turns up. He wants to shrink her brother because he hates him. And she says to him, "You can't be a supervillain. You don't look like one." And then she realizes that he is a supervillain, quickly changes it to her alter ego, Superhero Girl, beats him up, only for people to suddenly go, "Oh my God, Superhero Girl is beating up that hipster. Somebody stop her."
I object to the idea that anyone would complain about her beating up a hipster.
Oh no, you are actually right on that, because everyone else is going, "Meh." And the guy who says, "Somebody stop her," says, "Come on, people, hipsters feel paid too." And the other guy going, "I hate this stupid little weather inappropriate scarf."
Nice.
And then we come to her Canadianness, which is at the end. And she's asked by a reporter about her Canadianness.
I thought that was just an honorific title for Celine Dion.
No, no. She's asked by a reporter what makes her a Canadian superhero, and she can't answer. And because she can't answer, she upsets a certain group of people. The group of people she upsets is the League of Villainous Canadian Stereotypes, and they have a bone to pick with Superhero Girl. First up is the Lumberjack, followed by Double Double, fueled by the power of 1,000 Tim Horton coffees, La Toc Homme, who is brought to hideous life in a Quebec laboratory, and finally, Farley Mowat, who just says, "The boat who wouldn't die." I have no idea what the reference, except the lumberjack and the coffee thing.
I'm disappointed there's not an evil moose and a Mountie.
She basically gives them a speech, and then they end with a Canadian hug before she sends them flying out the ceiling with a hockey stick, and the line, "Also Canada is hockey," which it is.
Hold on. What's a Canadian hug?
I don't know. I don't know. And she meets this superhero called Spectacle, who's basically a socialite and a model by day. She gets these superpowers, but she protects her identity by wearing glasses when she's a superhero and not wearing glasses when she's not. And there's also a bit in this where the evil version of Superhero Girl comes back from the future and kidnaps the I think it's the mayor of Quebec or the president of Canada, one or the other. And so Spectacle comes to stop Superhero Girl. Superhero Girl meets with her from 10 years in the future, and the her from 10 years in the future explains how she turned evil, and it was at the end of a bad week, and her peanut butter toast just fell and landed peanut butter side down, and that's what drove her to turn evil.
This does sound quite fun.
It is a lot of fun.
If a little bit bizarre.
It is bizarre, but that I think that's what makes it. I mean, when she goes for a job interview, the main ninja in the city called King Ninja, whose real name is actually Trevor, he decides that he's going to mess up her day by going for the same job. And he actually gets the job. And because he's making more money working in finance than he does as a ninja, he quits being a ninja.
Okay.
So, yeah. The Adventures of Superhero Girl by Faith Erin Hicks. It's delightfully nonsensical, and I kind of love it.
Excellent stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure I would like it as much as I do, but it is just, it's delightful.
Right. I think I want something fun next time.
Well, no, you're not allowed fun, Mick.
I've covered this now, so if either you two want to read it.
No, I mean, I want something fun to cover for the show. I don't want a 600-pound in weight tome that's full of concept and no story. I want fun things. Whimsy.
All right, okay. We will keep our eyes open for whimsy, just for you, Mick.
Spoiler alert, no, we won't.
I mean,
and that brings us to the end of the show.
Yes, it does.
Compared to what I've reviewed this week, 2000 AD is whimsy.
All right, okay, so that's us for this week. All of our shows are available on iTunes and Audioboom or any other podcast provider of your choice. We are a part of the Geek Show Podcast Network, and we are now on Patreon, so please support us on there if you can. If you're a regular listener, we'll be posting all our shows on there as well as the usual places as well. We've got various tiers on Patreon. Have a look and choose which tier works for you. And we'll be back next week with more comic book, manga, and graphic novel goodness. Until then, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been Mick.
We'll see you all later.
And thanks for listening.